The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Agree with me for the moment that this is a very difficult story. And notwithstanding, if you will recall, we had a class on the concept of nisayon, of testing. And we said that ultimately, well, maybe we'll mention it briefly during the course of the class. This is a very difficult story. And there are a couple of underlying questions that I think I want to understand. First of all, obviously, what can possibly be the value of this? Now, assuming for the moment, and we're making this assumption, again and again, I keep repeating this, that we're looking at this as a divine story, in which case there must be some purpose and value to this. One of the difficulties, perhaps, in developing a relationship with Hashem may well be how one deals with this sort of a story. And there are those who would suggest, and they may be correct, that those of us who choose to believe in an unlimited being, entity, God, choose to do so as a cop-out. Because if there's a God, then there must be meaning and there must be purpose to this. At the same time, there is then a challenge to try to find meaning and purpose within this type of a story. So let's see what we got. What bothers you about this story? Did everybody get a chance to get through at least the whole text of the Akedah, right? Okay. The Akedah, by the way, comes from one of the verses here, right? Le'ekod, to bind up. Literally the binding of Isaac. Okay? So let me hear what your perceptions are. Yeah.
There's a precedent for him complaining about taking people's lives. And at the end of the story, he's actually rewarded for having gotten this.
In other words, this seems to be completely out of character for Avraham. Do you see that? That's very difficult. And why doesn't Avraham hear? Right? I mean, if Avraham previously, when God wants to destroy the supposedly wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, of Sodom and Gomorrah, so Abraham argues, he struggles with God. Here, he's a willing servant. Makes no sense. Why doesn't he struggle? Why doesn't he argue? Why doesn't he debate the issue? Very interesting.
And why is he rewarded?
And why is he rewarded? And what is that reward, by the way? I tell you now, I don't think we're going to get to that. But that's a very interesting question. Okay. What else?
Was it strange that Isaac was totally subservient to Abraham?
The second part of your question, of your query, which is that Isaac was 37, is not found in the text. That's Medrash. Now, we had a class on Medrash, and we spoke about rabbinic legend. And it makes a lot of sense that Isaac was probably around that age. That specific age, and what it means, since it comes from the Medrash rabbinic legend, the issue for me is not whether he was actually 37, but what I learned from that. Okay, where is Isaac in this story? You barely see him.
He's also challenged him as well.
Well, now that's another interesting question. Whose test is this?
Why did he decide to give him a test today?
Right, well, okay, what's this test doing here? What's the value of this test now? Hasn't God already reached the stage where he knows what Avraham can do? I mean, when you look at the story of Avraham's life, it's very difficult. The first time that God meets Avraham, he doesn't say, "Hey, Abe, how you doing? Come on in." He says, "Go!" Very strange. If you look at the beginning of the story of Abraham, in the portion known as Lech Lecha, right? In the I think it's the 12th chapter. The first time that God meets Abraham, God comes to Avraham and says, "Lech Lecha, go!" That's the first thing God ever says to Abraham. Get out of here. Leave your home, leave your family, leave your country, leave everybody. That's a very difficult thing to do. And now, and Abraham, according to tradition, goes through a whole series of tests, 10 tests according to the Mishnah. He's told there's a famine, he has to go down to Egypt. He has to deal with the fact that his nephew leaves him. He has to deal with the fact that his nephew is captured by an enemy and he has to go to war. All sorts of difficult tests. So God needs another one. Very difficult. But even more interesting, what you're raising here, where is Isaac in this story?
You know, you can learn a lot. There's a concept within biblical study known as numerology. So I'm not going to go into depth into how this works, but there is tremendous significance in numbers in the Torah. You may notice that certain numbers repeat themselves. For example, the number 40. So they're 40 days to the flood. And the Jews were in the desert for 40 years. And Moses goes up to Mount Sinai for 40 days. And the number 40 repeats itself. So the question is asked, well, is that just random or is there significance? Well, if the book is divine, and if God is choosing those periods of time, there must be some significance. And I see that certain numbers are significant. The number 7 is significant. The number 6 is significant. The number 8 is... all these numbers that keep repeating yourself. There's certain numbers you don't find. You very rarely find the number 5. It's just not a big number. You know, the 5 commandments. You don't find it. But the number 10. Number 10 is big. There are 10 sayings with which God creates the world. There are 10 generations between Adam and Noah, 10 generations, Noah and Abraham, 10 commandments, 10 plagues. So these certain numbers are significant. And there is a theory, and I won't go into right now the validity of this theory and how it works, that if I sense in a story that a certain number appears, and if I can relate that number to a certain idea, I can get an insight into that story. I'll give you maybe one example. The number 6 in Judaism always represents something that's incomplete. Right? There's 6 days of the week. But that's incomplete without Shabbat, without the seventh day. 6 years the land lies fallow, but that's incomplete without the seventh. So whenever I see the number 6, I know that something's incomplete, something's wrong. I'm looking for a seventh. For example, if you look at the story of Noah. So you can divide the story of Noah into sections. The first story of Noah is where he's born. The second story of Noah in the Bible is where God comes to Noah and tells him to build an ark. And the third section is where he gathers all the animals and builds the ark. And the fourth section is where he's in the flood. You know, whatever it is. In each one of those stories, and you can check this out, this is very easy to look up, you will find that the name Noah appears in each of those units 7 times. That's what you'll find. In the last story of Noah, which is when Noah leaves the ark, he plants a vineyard, which is a tremendous, tremendous thing to do when you think about it. I mean, to get out of an ark after a flood, being a survivor of a Holocaust the likes of which we have never seen, because the entire world was destroyed. Noah is the arch survivor. To get out of an ark and to plant is a tremendous act of faith. But something goes terribly wrong. He plants a vineyard. He eventually eats of the grapes. He gets drunk. He's found naked by his sons. And you sense in the Bible that this is the failure of Noah. He can't deal with creating a new world. Something goes awry, as it were. When you look at that story, in that story the name Noah appears 6 times. Because something's wrong. And then you find at the end of that portion that Abraham is born. And you find that the name Abraham appears 6 times. And that's really a question. Is Abraham going to be able to become that complete person that Noah wasn't able to become? The 7th time that the word Abraham appears in the Bible is essentially when God tells Abraham, go. Go to Israel. So I'm not for the moment suggesting what this is, and you have to see this through the Bible, and it takes years to appreciate the validity of this, and that's a very difficult idea, and you should be skeptical about such an idea. But just in terms of being sensitive, you know, if you look in our story here, and you can do this on your own, count how many times the name Abraham appears. And count how many times the name Isaac appears. And you will find that Abraham is clearly the significant character of this story. He is the one who is acting. He is the one who is commanded by God to fulfill whatever it is that's being fulfilled. There's no discussion with Isaac. Don't you think God should have come down and said to Isaac, listen, Izzy, I'm going to ask your dad to do a very weird thing. But I want you to have a little faith. No, it's just assumed. Listen, Abraham, take your son. Take him off to a mountain, tie him up, and sacrifice him. Well, don't ask him any questions. He'll go along with it. In fact, if you look at the character of Yitzchak, of Isaac, throughout his life, he is a very passive figure. Almost as if this experience shapes the rest of his life. I mean, you have to imagine what that must have been like. And I've mentioned to you before that on the one hand, we're trying to study Torah and look at these characters as human beings and study them from our perspective, at the same time bearing in mind that they still were, nonetheless, far beyond where we are. I mean, they spoke with God. So, granted that that takes into account all sorts of assumptions. We're assuming there is a God, we're assuming God's involved in the world. But if there's a God and they spoke with God, then certainly you have to appreciate that there is a certain pedestal that we put them on. But notwithstanding that, what do you do the morning after you're on an altar and your dad has tied you up and almost killed you? How do you go on with, that's not an easy thing. And that is Isaac.
But Isaac is not the actor here. He is the acted upon. Very passive figure. Why is that? And yet I call this the binding of Isaac. What else? Let's look at the story now. Okay? Let's take a look. I want you to know this is my favorite part. I am having so much fun doing this with you guys. I love this. Getting a little meat. First pasuk, okay? Vayi acharat vayi ma'ele. And it was after these things. That's a very strange line. Do you agree? That's a very weird line. Why do I have to say that? Assuming for the moment that this is a divine book and every word is important. What do you mean, and it was at, well, huh? This is chapter 22. It's obviously after chapter 21. So what does that mean? Anybody make a suggestion? I mean, the Torah doesn't make these comments sort of randomly. In other words, this story, it's important to understand that it follows the previous stories. Now, just out of curiosity, and we're not going to do this for lack of time, but what would you then automatically have to do if you really want to understand this story? You'd have to see what happened till now. Now, I will tell you one thing. Maybe what this means is you can't possibly understand this story fully in a vacuum. You have to know who Avraham is and who Yitzchak is and how Yitzchak was born and how long Avraham waited for Yitzchak and what kind of a person Avraham is in order to appreciate the significance of this story. See, I'm looking at a period of time with the Canaanite Mesopotamia. And when you think about it, child sacrifice was the norm. I mean, we have historical and archaeological evidence to the effect that, for example, Molech, which was a form of idolatry, involved child sacrifice. As a matter of fact, they used to pass the firstborn son of every family through the fire as an offering to Molech. Now that's something that's beyond the pale for us. We don't really understand that. And if you want to, by the way, understand the Bible's attitude towards idolatry, it's not so much that there was this tremendous problem with someone bowing down to a piece of wood. You know, hey, you want to talk to a piece of wood? Fine. You know, sometimes you see that in New York subway. But ultimately, it was many of the practices that went along with idolatry. I mean, cruelty and barbarism and paganism and child sacrifice and sexual fertility rites and all sorts of strange things that are sort of out of our cultural experience. But if I look at Abraham as a period of that time, this is a totally normal thing. Abraham woke up one morning, told everybody God had told him, you know, came to him in the night, woo-hoo, and told him to sacrifice his son. Well, that's normal. The only thing that's weird is why he waits 3 days to do it, but okay. So the Torah is saying, no. Appreciate who we're talking about here. Appreciate that this is somebody who went to war to save life. That this is someone who argued with God to save life. That this is someone who epitomizes kindness. That this is someone who 3 days after his circumcision is sitting in the heat of the day and runs to bring guests into his home. And from that perspective, this is a very difficult story. Okay, so God tests Abraham. Let's put that aside for the moment. And he says to Abraham, what? That's what Abraham says. God says, Abraham. That's also a very strange line. We think of communication in our human form, right? And it may well be that the Torah can't possibly verbalize an abstract idea like God communicating with man, because there's no way to express it. So it could be that what we're reading here is just the closest thing that we can imagine to that type of communication. But I would imagine that if God comes to speak to me, he doesn't have to say, Ben. He just, like, God's there. And you all of a sudden realize that God has a message. Now, can you imagine, you know, imagine that you write a letter, right? I write a letter to Joanne. And I forget to write, Dear Joanne. So I say, listen, you know, I hope you enjoyed Israelite, and I hope you enjoyed Before That Leaves Note, and I hope you're having a good time in Israel, and it was a pleasure having you, and whatever. So at the end of the letter, Joanna says, you know, it's really weird. He didn't write Dear Joanna. Maybe he's giving me a message. Is the letter really for me? Maybe it's a mistake. So I read the letter to figure out it's for me. But if God comes to you and has a discussion with you, And God says to you, listen, take your son. So you don't say, wait a second, who is this? I mean, who else could it be? And are you talking to me? Duh. So that's a very strange line. Perhaps
it gives me some form of an idea of the relationship between God and Abraham. I'm not sure. But let's say that at this stage we're just noticing, right? We're noticing. This is our learning. What's even more interesting to me is Abraham's response. What is Abraham's response? Here I am. Oh! Good you told me that! What do you think Abraham is saying? And I want you to know, this is a very deep idea. What is contained in this word. What do you think God, Abraham is saying? Here I am. Pardon? He's saying, here I am. He's saying, I'm yours. And if you look, by the way, this is also a very interesting and very important tool in learning. I mentioned once to you the use of a concordance. Do you remember that? There's a text, a reference book, which one can look up and discover every place in the Bible that a word appears. So I said that sometimes when you look up a word, that's very difficult. Like looking up the word Vayomer, and God said it's very difficult because there's thousands of them. This is a very unique word. You don't find it that often. If you look at the word Hineni, here I am, everywhere in the Bible, you will find that it always signifies that. As a matter of fact, sometimes you'll come across a place where it says Hineni, right? And you won't really understand the significance of it, except that there's an echo of a previous story. In the middle of the story of Moshe, of Moses, when he says to God, Hineni, here I am, you will find the rabbis all of a sudden discussing Abraham in their comments on that verse. And you don't understand why. What does Abraham have to do with Moshe? And then you notice that that word Hineni is there. And Moshe is putting himself at the service of Hashem, just as Abraham did. And I want to go you a stage further. Ultimately in life, we're searching for meaning, right? We're searching for some higher purpose. One of the challenges, I think, in finding that purpose, whatever that purpose is for all of us, is that purpose there to serve me, or am I at the service of that purpose? I'll give you a great example. About a year ago, a year and a half ago, I don't even remember, a group of people approached me. They wanted me to open up a yeshiva. I had a great idea for a yeshiva, a women's seminary. And sometimes you see an idea and you know it's going to succeed. They had all the necessary ingredients. They wanted to teach girls Torah in a very new sort of way. They wanted to focus more on biblical study and less on philosophy. They wanted to teach textual skills. They had a list of teachers who they were willing to hire who were quite excellent. There were a lot of girls who were looking for that sort of place where they would have teachers who wouldn't just come teach a class and leave, but become a part of their daily experience, looking for rebbeim, rabbis who would inspire them, etc., etc., etc. An open-minded, open-attitude yeshiva, you know, along the philosophy of, let's say, Israelite. They had a sugar daddy, somebody who was willing to, someone actually just passed away, but someone who was willing to put up something like $1 million to get this thing off the ground. So they had all the ingredients there. And I had absolutely no doubt that if we opened it, they wanted me to, you know, head this yeshiva, be the Rosh Yeshiva. And I had no doubt that if we started this yeshiva, that the first year we'd have 30 or 40 girls, the next year we'd have 40 or 50 girls, and by the third year we'd have 100. No doubt whatsoever. But I wasn't sure, is this what I wanted to do? Did I want to spend my life teaching girls who knew a lot of Torah, more Torah? And don't get me wrong, that's a very valid thing, to create Jewish leadership, Jewish women leadership, especially today. But that was my question, did I really want that? So I went to talk to a couple of people, including Rabbi Riskin, who is my Rebbe, who's my teacher. And he gave me a very good piece of advice. He said, you know, there are two types of yeshivot. There's a yeshiva which is established because there's just a need for that program. And finally someone says, we have to start this program, there's a need for it. So I'll start it. Right? There's a certain audience. There was a school that started for the deaf, a Jewish school for the deaf. There were no Jewish schools for the deaf. And someone, actually a Holocaust survivor, a phenomenal story, realized upon having a deaf child, and that child reached a certain age, there were no Jewish educational schools for the deaf in Israel. So he opened one up. It wasn't... There's another kind of yeshiva, another kind of school. The other kind of school is you have someone who wants to be a Rosh Yeshiva. Someone wants to be the head of a school. So he finds a way to start a school so he can be the head of a school. So he said to me, you have to decide which one this is. Do you really feel there's an incredible need for this yeshiva? And there are the other yeshivot that meet this need for women. So maybe they don't have exactly that approach in terms of Bible studies. So you have to add a course to that yeshiva. But do you really need a whole other yeshiva? Or would you be better off serving or doing in a different direction? It's a very good piece of advice. And you can see that it influenced my decision because I didn't open up the yeshiva. That's what Avram is saying. And I want you to know, you can have any purpose in the world, however altruistic, however magnificent, serving you, or you can be serving it. I can be teaching Torah to make myself a Torah scholar, or I can be teaching Torah because I want to give Torah to other people. And there's a world of difference. And you could be doing all the same things. One will be successful and one won't. One will reach from your heart into someone else's heart and one won't. It's that simple. And it's true in everything we do with life. I can become a lawyer because I recognize that an honest lawyer is hard to come by. And you can do so much good as a lawyer, or I can become a lawyer because I want $100,000 a year. I can become a pediatric neurosurgeon because as a pediatric neurosurgeon, I can help the family of a child get through some of the most difficult experiences they'll ever have. Or I can become a pediatric neurosurgeon so my name appears in medical journals. That's what Avram is saying here. Hineni, here I am. I'm not here for me. I'm here for you. And whatever you feel I can do to serve you, that's what I'll do. Because the you in this case, Hashem, is Avraham's purpose. Tremendous idea. But okay. And now comes a very difficult line. And as I'm going, if you notice something, so stop me and okay? Because I'm on a roll. Vayomer, kachna et bincha, et yechidcha asher ahavta et yitzchak. This is an incredible line. And do you see how incredible this line is? Take your son, your only son, the son that you love, Yitzchak. It cannot be random that this story occurs immediately after the story of Yishmael that we just saw. As a matter of fact, I happen to think that that's very much what it means when it says, and after these things. After the story of Yishmael, where Abraham chases Yishmael out of the house, albeit at the behest of Sarah, albeit at the behest of God, Avram is given this test. I don't think that's accidental. I think you're right. But okay. Who do you think Yitzchak is? Why is God saying this? God could say, take your son. And you'd probably know it was Yitzchak. Or God could say Yitzchak, so you'd know it wasn't Yishmael. I could buy that also. Your son, your only son, the one you love. Very powerful line. Perhaps it's becoming clear to those reading this story that this is not an easy thing for Avram to do. I want you to know, I would be very hard-pressed to imagine that anyone could, in their wildest imagination, imagine that God is going to ask of them to do this. I want to tell you, by the way, something else. I want to tell you, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, what the Akedah means to me. I think that there are modern-day Abraham and Sarahs that live in this country. And I think they go to Har Herzl on Memorial Day, and they stand at the graves of their sons, of their Isaacs. And I think that when you stand at the grave of your son, it must be that at that moment, that is your son, your only son, the son you love. And I don't imagine that any of those couples who lost a child could possibly have imagined that that was what God was somehow going to ask of them to do. I want to tell you what Rabbi Erskine once told me, that when he made Aliyah, it was very difficult. Both sets of parents, grandparents, lived in America. And his parents gave him a very hard time. His wife's parents gave them a hard time. And only half kiddingly, they started an American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Grandchildren. And she said to him, how can you take my grandchildren to Israel and force them to put on a uniform and go up to Lebanon? And I want you to know, there is no answer to that question. Rav Rizkin's youngest son, he should be safe and he should be well, is in an elite unit, and he's serving in the north, and he's been places without passports that you and I wouldn't dream of. And don't think that his mother, the Rabbanit, sleeps well at night when he's up there. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And I want to tell you something. I didn't find it that difficult to do it myself. I can't even begin to imagine what it's going to be like if, God forbid, and it seems to me that there isn't going to be a way out of it, that Yonatan has to put on a uniform and go to battle. That's a very difficult thing, and that's what God is asking of Avram to do. And I want to try to understand that. And then, it says, Lech Lecha. What does that remind you of? Go, we just saw that. Same exact words. The first words that God speaks to Abraham, Lech Lecha, in the first test, whatever that means, are the exact same words, the exact same phrase that God gives Abraham in this test, Lech Lecha. And that's a very powerful expression. Lech Lecha, go, Lecha to you. You still have to find out who you are, maybe. You have to think about that. And I want to remind you, by the way, I'm opening up all these windows. And then we'll take a little bit of it and we'll take a look at it. But don't think we're going to be able to cover all of these issues. For me, part of the beauty of Torah is not asking a question and getting an answer or arriving at a response. For me, the beauty of Torah is asking a lot of questions and realizing they're still out there and there's so much to study and so much to think about and so much beauty to... So, go to the land of Moriah. Now that's, I want you to know, an incredible thing. Because we're studying this story about 200 yards from the place where tradition has it took place. By the way, this is a tradition common to both Judaism and Islam. That the mountain of Moriah is the site of the temple. Har HaMoriah. And there's a lot of evidence of this in the Bible, if you accept the Bible. So, God is telling Abraham, in Hebron, which is all the way due south, take a journey, and go up to the hills of Moriah, and offer up your son. V'ha'alehu sham le'olah. And offer him up as a whole burnt offering, al achad he'arim asher omar elecha. On one of the mountains that I will tell you. Now ask me a question. I'll read the verse again. Take your son, go to the mountains of Moriah, right? Go to the mountain of Moriah, Har HaMoriah, and offer up your son on one of the mountains that I will tell you. He just said, take him to Mount Moriah. But then he says, to the mountain that I tell you. So which is it? El Eretz HaMoriah, the land of Moriah. Now I want you to know, nobody calls this area the land of Moriah. They all call it Har HaMoriah. What else? More so.
Why here?
Yeah,
why not just...
Yeah, why not? I mean, here, go out in your backyard and build an altar. Why go off all the way over there? So if God came to me today, God forbid, that's a strange phrase, I have to think about that, and said, take your son, you know, to... So then I understand, take him to Mount Moriah, because that's where Jerusalem is, and that's where the temple is. But back then, there was nothing there.
He gives you 3 days to wrestle with in his own mind.
Oh. So now I know we're learning. When people start to give responses that are given in the Medrash, that are given by the Vilna Gaon, that are given by the Ramban, then I know we're cooking. You see, it wouldn't be a big deal if God said to Abraham, okay, quick, go outside, take your son, shecht him, slaughter him. And we know in human history how many acts have been committed out of religious zeal. It's almost as though the Torah is telling me, I want you to struggle with this. I want you to do this out of a conscious decision. Not because you wake up one morning and you see God and you run outside and do what you do. I remember vividly when I was in high school, the Ayatollah Khomeini died. And they had this mass funeral. Hundreds of thousands, I don't know, millions of people in Iran. And they're all standing out there in the sun around the grave of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Right? I mean, millions of people. They have no cable TV there, so nothing better to do. And they're out there. And they're beating themselves, and they're screaming, and they're yelling. And I remember that about 20 or 30 people start climbing up and trying to grab on the coffin. And the revolutionary guards start pushing them back. And a struggle breaks out. And people die, and they're shooting. The zeal is a very dangerous thing. No. You and Isaac alone. And it's interesting that we see that Abraham says, right, to the two boys, the lads that are with him, right, Shvulachem po, v'ani v'anar nelchad ko. You sit here, Isaac and I are going to go on alone, Yitzchak and I are going to go on together. Avram has to walk up to this mountain alone with his son.
It has to come from here and here. Now watch what happens. Vayashkem Avram Baboker. Avram arises in the morning. The word Vayashkem is a very powerful word. Okay? It doesn't just mean to get up. Does anybody remember where else I see this word? Look back a couple of pages. The previous page, page 21. Look in verse 14. And Avram rose up early in the morning. Vayashkem Avram Baboker. Same word. And the rabbis suggest that this word implies that if I'm doing the will of God, I don't just trudge to it, I run to it. It's a mitzvah. You can learn a lot by how a person walks to synagogue. You know? There are people who run to shul and stroll home, and there are people who stroll to shul and run home. Right? That's just the way life is. When I was in Pittsburgh for a year, I remember there was a group of teachers from a particular, whatever, they were taken out of a rabbinical program because they opened up a yeshiva high school and they needed Jewish teachers, so they naturally assumed, who are we going to get to teach our children? The rabbis. And these guys had no formal educational training. They had no teaching methodology, no behavioral psychology, no group dynamics, nothing. They had never learned how to teach Bible, but they knew the laws of kashrut. So, you can already guess my impression. So, you know, some of them came, and they were wonderful, wonderful people. Completely out of their depth. I remember once one of them came over to me, you know, we were talking about what we were teaching, because I had taken a job that year, because we were there for my mother-in-law wasn't well. And I said, well, I'm teaching Gemara, I'm teaching Talmud to the 12th graders, I'm teaching this. Oh, why are you teaching Gemara? You're so lucky, I have to teach prophets. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be a great class for this guy. And you would see these teachers, it was my ultimate nightmare. My ultimate fear as a teacher, to be what we called in the army a Tisha Efes Chamesh. You get up at 9, Tisha, you go to work and do Efes, nothing, and then you run home at 5. That's what they call it, a 9:05, right? And these guys, you would see them, and I used to skateboard to work, that's a story in and of itself, and I used to, because it was all downhill and I had a skateboard and what the heck, right? And I used to fly down this hill, and I would see these rabbis literally trudging to work. And when the day ended at 4 in the afternoon or whatever it was, right? So I was always the last one out of the building. And I never noticed it. Because, you know, you're talking to a student, you're discussing something, you get involved, whatever. 4:01, they were gone. And they were running home. And they would just walk out, they were all happy, excited. And when you would see them in the morning at 9, they were all like, yeah, how you doing, you know? Like the runner at the Wall Street firm. Now, God forbid that I should judge other people, but God forbid that I should ever become a teacher like that. That's my ultimate fear as a teacher. If I ever felt that way, I would give it up and go to Honolulu. But that's what Avram is saying. Even this, Vayashkem. If you're going to do a mitzvah, you want to develop a relationship with that mitzvah. You want that mitzvah to affect you in a positive way. You want it to become meaningful. You want to glean from it what you can glean from it. Begin up here. If you're going to give charity, if you're going to give tzedakah, you can give the same 50 cents in very different ways. Right? You can give your 50 cents like, here you go. Or you can give your 50 cents and it can come from the heart. You're not giving the same 50 cents. Now don't get me wrong here. I don't think the average person gets up in the morning and puts tefillin on. Whoa, this is incredible! Yes! No, jump out of bed. Can't wait to pray today! But realize that the closer you can get to that, the more valuable it becomes, and it starts from up here. That's what Avram does. However, I pointed this out to you for another reason, which I'll get to. Alright. So he gets up. He saddles his donkey. Takes two boys. Takes Yitzchak, Beno. Now, look very interesting. What word is completely superfluous in this verse? Verse 3. There's a word there that I do not need. And again, if I'm reading Bible from the divine perspective, it's there for a reason.
His son?
I mean, I know that it's his son. And you find that word is there all the way through. And the Torah is telling me how difficult this is for Abraham. You know, there's a very dangerous thing. First of all,
What would be the natural thing for Abraham to do? He's going to offer up his son. Distance himself, right? He doesn't do that. And it's clear that he's doing this with his son. He understands fully what he's doing. Which of course makes this all the more difficult. And he takes the trees, and they go to the place that God tells him. And it's interesting, on the third day, Bayom HaShlishi, Vayisav Ram et Enav, Vayaret Hamakom Merachok. And he sees the place from afar. You know, I'm not going to get too deep into the mysticism of this word, but you ever hear the song Baruch HaMakom? You ever hear that song? No, right? Well, in the Haggadah, we read a verse, it's not a verse, it's a saying, Baruch HaMakom, blessed is the place. And the place refers to God. And there's an idea in Jewish tradition that God is everywhere, and therefore one of the names for God is the Makom, right? The place. So what is Avram exactly seeing? Since God has said, I'm going to show you the place, and now Avram already sees it, what is that? But that's a very difficult thing. I'm not going to get to an answer to that question, but you have to see that. And Avram is looking. It takes him 3 days to make this journey. Vayomer Avram el Narav, so Avram says, you sit here, and we will go. Vayikach Avram et atzei Allah, and he takes the trees, vayasem al Yitzchak beno, and he has his son carry them. Vayikach biyado et ha'eshet v'acharet, and he takes the flint and the fire, whatever that means, the knife and the flint. Vayelchu shnehem yachdav, and they both walk on together. Now comes two very powerful verses which change the flow of the story. Because now Yitzchak gets involved. Vayomer Yitzchak el Avraham Aviv. You see it again. The father-son relationship. Vayomer Avi, he says, my father. Vayomer, Hineni Bni. Same word. I mean, do you see the conflict here? I'm here for God, and I'm here for you. You know what the difference between a parent and a babysitter is? What makes me a father and not just a babysitter for my children? Is that I live for them. And what makes them happy makes me happy. And that's what Avram is saying here. I mean, you're my life. It's a very difficult thing to do things in life that you know are going to cause your children pain. Sometimes it's a physical thing, you know, your child has to get a shot at the doctor. Sometimes it's an emotional thing, you have to discipline your child. The reason that that's difficult is because ultimately, what's life for if not for your children? And now God, well, what's life for if not for God? And those two are in conflict. How do you deal with that? What does that mean? He says, I see the fire, I see the wood, I see the knife. Where is the lamb? Where is the sacrificial lamb? You know what's missing in between these two verses? In between verse 7 and verse 8? You know what's missing? What's missing is a space as wide as the Grand Canyon. How do you answer a question like that? I mean, he says, where's the lamb? And it's just him and Avram. How do you answer your son? Vayomer Avraham, Elohim yir elo haseh le'olah b'ni. God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering, my son. And the rabbis do a play on words. The rabbis say, before the word b'ni, before the word my son, don't put a comma, put a colon. God will provide a lamb for the altar, colon, b'ni, my son, you. Now realize, when we're talking and to whom we're speaking, Yitzchak has to know what's going on now. He's walking up alone to a mountain. They've got firewood and a knife. He senses something's wrong with his lamb. Abraham says, God will provide the lamb. Yeah. And he lives in a time where a child sacrifice is the norm. And he is the child. So he knows. And if that's true, then what comes next is an incredibly powerful line. Vayelchu shnehem yachdav, and they both walk together. Of one purpose and of one mind. He to take a life, he to give a life. And they're sharing this purpose. And I wonder if I'm correct, if from a certain perspective, this isn't the exact point at which Avraham passes on Jewish tradition to his son. Saying to the next generation, the things in life that are meaningful to you are determined very often by what you're willing to sacrifice for them. I'll give you an example. I live in Efrat, and I love Efrat very much. And I live in a house, and when we first married, it was very difficult. It's not easy to figure out a way to get a house, you and the bank, and then also the bank, and the bank, and the bank. But I love my house. If somebody told me, my house or my child, so you wouldn't hesitate. Because as much as I love my house, it's not what I live for. My child's what I live for. So I learn a lot about what's meaningful to a person by what they're willing to give up for certain things. I get offers all the time to teach in different places, right? You can imagine, teachers in Israel, you know, and sometimes the money is great. And most often the reason that I say no is because I just don't have the time to spend with my family. So that makes a statement. My family is more important to me than the money, etc. So how come I'm sitting here today? Because there are things that are even more important than that. And you learn a lot about a person by where they put their time. If you're, a businessman, and you spend 20 hours a day in your business, and you give up everything to see that business succeed, and then you wake up one day and your kids are 25 and you don't know them, and you thought all along that your family was your priority, that your business was for your family, and all of a sudden you look back and you realize they weren't really your priority, because you gave them up for your business. Yitzchak, perhaps, is making a very powerful statement. Are there things that I'm willing to give up everything for? What, after all, is the most valuable possession I have? Me! My life! Are there things that are even more important than that? And that's not an easy thing. And I wonder how one would even consider that question if there is only this life. But certainly if this life doesn't become meaningful unless there's some value to it somewhere else beyond, are there things that are even more important than life? I can desecrate Shabbat on the off chance there might be desecration of a human life. Not only can I desecrate Shabbat to save a human life, but the code of Jewish law, which we're going to study about tomorrow, the day after, makes a point of telling me that if there's a group of people standing around, the greatest Torah scholar is the one who has to jump into the sea and save the person in danger on Shabbat. It's a very strange statement. What do you mean? Whoever's closest should jump in. And I think what the halakha they were saying is that the definition of a Torah scholar is that he understands that the value of human life is so paramount that it takes precedence over everything. And that knowledge of Torah, that understanding of the depth and beauty of Torah, motivates him to jump in before anyone else is motivated. That's the definition of Torah. That's tremendous. There is nothing more important than human life. And yet there are instances where I give up human life. Defining what those things are, that's a very difficult thing. Yitzchak is here making a statement that there is something which is more important to me even than life itself. Somehow. My relationship with Hashem, with God. Whatever that means. Purpose in the world. Making the world a better place. Accepting that I'm put here for a reason. And that's very difficult. And they go to the place, and they build the altar, and they set up the trees. And they place him on, Abraham places him on the altar, above the trees, above the wood. And the Torah is describing it. It's not like, you know, Abraham goes up there and just can't bear to look, so he throws him down, takes the knife. It's a thought out procedure. He has to build the altar, he has to put the wood there, he has to tie up his son, he has to put him on top of the wood. And where's Yitzchak? You know what I've always wondered when I read these stories? Where are Yitzchak's and Abraham's eyes? Are their eyes locked during this process?
I met a woman once who came to study, not an Israelite, but before I was an Israelite, with her daughter. And I noticed that they had an incredible relationship. They were just, you could see, they were inseparable. And they were more than just parent and daughter, they were also friends. You could see there's a very deep relationship. And I said once, you know, I was talking with the daughter about some issues that she was having, something we were studying. And I said, you know, I have to say, you have an amazing relationship with your mother. And it's not often that you see that close, that intense a relationship. And I think it's a beautiful thing to see. She said, I don't think you understand my relationship with my mother. She said, about 3 years ago, I was very ill. And I needed a kidney transplant. And my mother gave up her kidney for me. And she said, before we had the operation, and apparently I don't know all the details of it, but it's not a simple operation and there's a lot of danger involved. It's not so clear afterwards with one kidney how you're going to survive and if you're going to survive, although they say that it's doable. She said, before we went into the operation and before they gave us the anesthesia, so my mother looked over at me, we were on two gurneys next to each other. And she took my hand and she looked in my eyes and she said, I love you. She said, it was the most powerful moment of my life. This is like a, I don't know, 22-year-old, 23-year-old girl. I mean, could you imagine? There are things that are more powerful than life itself. Where is Yitzchak's eyes? Where are they during this story? Are they locked on Avraham's? Or can they not even look at each other? I'm not sure. I'm not even sure what it would mean. But this is an intense, intense, intense story. Vayishlach Avram et yado, and God sends out his hand. Vayikach et ha-ma'achelet lishchot et beno, and he takes the knife to slaughter his son. You know, it's like everything is in slow motion. And so far, the story is going in an obvious direction. And all of a sudden, things change. And everything goes topsy-turvy. And I have to be honest with you, at this point, I don't understand what's going on. So an angel calls out from the sky and says, Avram, Avram! You know, you almost sense like, no, 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 no! And Avram says, Hineni, I'm doing this for you. I'm here. I'm your tool. I am the knife. And God says, Al tishlach yad chayel anar. Don't send out your hand to the boy. V'al ta'as lo ma'uma, and don't do anything to him. Ki atayadati, for now I know ki yirei Elohim ata, that you will call it fear of God. It's not quite a simple expression. Yirat Hashem, or fear of God, understanding God's presence. We have to see. Velo chasachta et bincha et yachidcha mimeni, and you didn't hold back even your son, your only son, from me. And then Vayisav Ramat Enav, Avram lifts his eyes. He sees there's a ram. They take the ram. It's caught up in the horns. There's a whole relationship here with Rosh Hashanah. We blow the ram's horn. And he takes the ram and he gives it up as a sacrifice instead of his son, etc., 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 etc. What is going on here? First of all, what's going on with God? I mean, what did God wake up one morning saying, you know, everything I give Abraham to do, he does. Let's see if he'll do this one. Now, Avraham knows. I mean, God knows what Avraham's going to do because God is God. So, how does that make Avram feel? My God says, take your son, slaughter him. No, 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 just kidding. Just wanted to see if you would do it. Is that my image of God? Is that the relationship that I want to have with a loving God? How do I deal with that? Tremendous challenge in this story. And what does it mean? And what's the angel? So I want to tell you a couple of things. And there are a couple of things that you will find those who disagree with. And I'm sharing with you my perspective on this story based on Chazal, based on traditional commentaries. But there are many different ways to look at this story. And I would leave you at the end of this class with a challenge. Because no big deal to hear what I think of this story. The real challenge after mulling this around is to decide what you think about this story. What does this mean? And eventually, if you really pursue this story, to then see what different commentaries say. And to challenge their perspectives. And to figure out why they say what they say. Because there's a very, very deep meaning in this story. I want you to know, we read this story on Rosh Hashanah. This is the Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah, which is one of the most important days in the Jewish calendar. We blow a ram's horn. And one of the reasons we blow a ram's horn in the shofar, which is the center of the Rosh Hashanah service, which is the epitome of repentance, of man's ability to change, which represents, according to the Zohar, according to the Book of Splendor, mysticism, a call to God that forces God, whatever this means, to alight from his chair of justice and sit instead on his chair of mercy and his throne of mercy. I almost can force God to be merciful by blowing the shofar. So I want to tell you a few things. First, I want to tell you what I think is going on here with Abraham. And then I want to tell you why I think this story happens here. And then I want to see who's tested and whether the test is passed. So first of all, what's going on with Abraham? I want you to know, if I would ask Rabbi Cordoza, could he hold the door for me while I'm going out with a bunch of bags? I mean, it would be amazing to me if I could get that question out before he offered. So that if he then held the door open for me, the fact that I say thank you is merely perfunctory. Because that's who he is. And I expect it of him already. I know that he is a person in whom kindness and chesed is so inherent that it would be against his nature not to hold the door open. And you meet people like this sometimes. You can't imagine them doing something unkind. And it's not a challenge to act within my nature. Sometimes what is most difficult is to act out of character. Now this raises two issues. First of all, how do I create such a character frame? And I want to tell you, Rav Dessler has a tremendous idea. Rav Dessler, Rav Eliyahu Dessler, was a rabbi in England, actually. He had a little shtetl, a little shul, a little synagogue in London. He eventually went to Gateshead and had a yeshiva there. He was one of the most underappreciated Torah scholars in our modern day. He sat in a little synagogue, and he was like the rabbi of the synagogue. And in England, in those days, a rabbi meant, you know, you were the sort of the figurehead. You gave the sermon Shabbat morning, maybe, and if people needed something, but you know, you didn't. There was no big newspaper interviews. So he sat and learned most of the day. And it's clear that the Jewish community there did not realize who they had sitting in their midst. Until almost posthumously, when some of his works began to be published. And then they realized what an incredible Torah scholar they'd had amongst them. In fact, I once met someone, because Rav Dessler Shul was my great-grandfather's shul, I once met someone who knew Rav Dessler. And he knew him quite well. And I said, can you tell me some Torah from Rav Dessler? I mean, I've read through the Michtav Meliyahu, the letters that he wrote, and the articles that he wrote, and tremendous stuff. And by the way, as an ethical pursuit, as a book which is designed to give you a picture of Jewish ethics and the beauty of Jewish philosophy and Jewish ethics and even mysticism, I know very few works that are translated into English that are as powerful, as meaningful, as incredible. I tell you that if you read this, you probably won't put it down. It's called Strive for Truth. There's a copy of it actually in the back here. I urge you, go take a look at it. It's incredible. And you know those little Feldheim pocketbooks? So now they've published it in the pocketbook like version. You can take one, put it in your pocket, walk on the bus with it, and climb ethical mountains on the bus. It's unbelievable. Anyway, if you read Rav Dessler, also I asked this guy, did he know any Torah from Rav Dessler? Could he tell me a Dvar Torah? He couldn't think of one. Could you imagine? He knew Rav Dessler for 10 years. He couldn't even think. He didn't know to ask him. They didn't know. And this happens all the time. We have great people who sit amongst us, and we don't realize their stature until maybe they're gone. Rav Shlomo Kalbach was such a person. People didn't appreciate him when he was alive. All the people who didn't appreciate him when he was alive walk around humming his nigunim and telling his stories today. But okay, such is life. Rav Dessler says an unbelievable thing. He says, you know, the evil inclination, we'll call it for the moment, the Yetzer Hara, that part of me, that drive within me, that I guess leads me off the path, that tempts me, the part of my nature that I have to sort of deal with every day, you know? Like, we recognize it internally that there are some things that we do that are positive and some things we do that are less than positive. I don't like to say negative, but less than positive, right? So you walk into a store, and you know that if you buy apples and pears and you eat them, it's good for you. And you know that if you buy a super crunchy, delicious Dunkin' Donut, it's not so good for you. It may be holy, but it's not so good for you, right? And so all the time we have this struggle. And someone says, as you're walking out the door and you're running to get home, can I just ask you a quick question? And you know that what you should do is you stop and say, of course, you know, what can I do? And let's talk. And sometimes you say, I really can't, I gotta run. And you walk home, and of course you can't smile the whole way home because you know that what you should be doing, right? That's the way life is, right? So, he says, everyone has that. And you can't destroy it. Judaism doesn't want you to try to destroy it. That's not a Jewish approach. Judaism doesn't say, go up on the mountain and sit in a monastery and fight your evil inclination and don't get married and live outside the world. Judaism says, channel it, funnel it. So you can't destroy it, and there's value to it. Because the same energy that may lead me to Times Square with a hooker can also, motivate me to create a family and bring children into the world, etc. So I have to take that energy, that sexual drive, that drive for acquisition, and I have to use it positively. Okay. But says Rav Dessler, even though you can't destroy it, you can play around with the range of it. And this is an incredible idea. He says everybody has a range. Think of it as two lines. A high point and a low point. And here is my area of temptation. And what I can do is I can play around with that area. I can say, if the Vilna Gaon, if Rashi, if Maimonides was walking down the street, and a beautiful married woman walked by, I don't imagine that they had this tremendous urge to go grab her, throw her in an alleyway, and have their way with her. It's just not in their mindset. I don't walk by McDonald's and think, oh, I wish I could have a cheeseburger. I didn't grow up with that. And whatever temptations I might have had in the past, I'm so beyond that, and I've so grown accustomed to not having it. So it's no big deal that I walk by McDonald's and don't have a cheeseburger. It doesn't mean anything. Because it's not my range. It's not my temptation. It's not my struggle. I have other struggles. If I sit at a table and someone says something negative about somebody, do I have the ability to get up and walk away or to find a way to refocus that energy or whatever it might be? Everybody has their struggles. Part of the difficulty of that struggle is attempting sometimes to go against your nature, to change who you are. Sometimes you can look in the mirror and you can decide, I don't like who I am today. It bothers me. I'll tell you a quick story. This is a story I heard from Shlomo Kalbach. There was a Jew, an American rabbi. And he came to, this is a number of years ago, and he came to Israel, and he was here for 9 days for a visit. He got some leave from his congregation, needed some air. And a Jew, a rabbi, first day, where does he go to pray in the morning? The Kotel. So he comes to the Kotel right down here to pray. Now, I don't know if you've had this experience, but you can try what I do. When I go to the Kotel, I usually end up wearing a tie. Try walking to the Kotel with a tie on, right? What happens? You get the sea of hands, right? Everybody wants, a shekel, a dollar, whatever it is. American, please to give money, right? And, you want to go catch a minyan, you want to go catch a prayer service, whatever, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and then you have a meeting and whatever else it is. But it takes you half an hour until you get to the Kotel. And, the first person you see, of course, what a mitzvah, it's the Kotel, I can give tzedakah before I pray, that's wonderful. And the second person, yes, I'd love to give you two. And the third person, look, I wish I had some more. By the 15th, already you're losing it. Anyway, this guy finally makes his way to the Kotel. It takes him 20 minutes to get through all the people and their stories and their hands, and can't you give a dollar, and that's all, and what about more, and everything else. And he finally gets to the Kotel. And finally he has a brief moment in between where he can put his tefillin on, right? And a beggar comes over to him. And he's right up at the wall. He's like up in the corner there and he's all meek God in the Kotel. It's great. And some guy taps him on the shoulder and he's like putting on his tefillin. There's a custom, whatever. You don't speak when you're in the middle of putting on your tefillin, your phylacteries. And the guy, sort of pulls on his arm and says, please, can you just give me something? And he turns and says, could you give me a break? I gave to all your friends and all your cousins and all your neighbors. Go wait in the back. When I finish praying, if I see you, I'll give you, leave me alone. And he goes back to his praying. Can you pray after you say something like that? Could you find joy in saying the Shema, hear about God, when you couldn't even listen to a Jew who was suffering? Can't do it. His prayer, which he had hoped would be like Yom Kippur, became like Tisha B'Av. He couldn't concentrate on his davening. So he davened quickly, and when he finished, he figured he'd go find the beggar and he'd apologize. And he'd give him whatever he wanted. He didn't even know what he wanted from him. Couldn't find him. He was gone. And he felt terrible. And you know, sometimes you're mean, and you just realize you really need to rectify this. In Kabbalah and mysticism, it's called tikkun. We make mistakes. We have to fix them. There's a ripple now on the smooth water of our existence, and we have to fix that. So he offers up a silent prayer. He says, please do me a favor. I'm here for 9 days. Let me find this beggar. Let me make amends. So he decides the next day he's going to come back to the hotel. He'll find the beggar. He'll give him stucker. He feels terrible. Comes the next day, the beggar's nowhere to be found. To make a story short, he comes every 9 days, all 9 days. He comes every day to the hotel. By the fifth day, he's going to the afternoon service at the hotel. On Shabbat, he walks down to the hotel. He can't find this guy. And he looks everywhere, and he goes to the Jaffa Gate, thinking maybe he'll see him sitting there, and he goes to the Zion Gate one day, can't find him. And on the ninth day, he finally realizes he's not going to find him, and he feels terrible. And he gets on a bus from the hotel to go to Meir Shearim to buy some Jewish books. And as he's sitting on this bus, who gets on after him and sits down right behind him? This beggar. And he sees him, and he recognizes him. And the guy is sitting behind him. He turns around and says, don't you recognize me? And the guy smiles. And he says, you, the first day that I was here, you came over, I was at the hotel, you wanted some money, and I feel so bad, I was so rude to you, I'll tell you what I want to do to make it up to you. I don't usually talk like that to people, I want to give you $100. So the beggar looks at him, he says, don't you recognize me? And the rabbi looks at him, he says, no. He says, I'm David Cohen. I grew up with you on the Lower East Side. Don't you recognize me? And the guy looks at him, and you know, vague familiarity crosses his face. He says, we grew up near each other. He says, I didn't want any money from you. I just want to come over and just say hello. You know, I was just, you know, you walk over to someone and say, hi, how you doing? I hadn't seen you since we grew up. Now, this David Cohen didn't know this. But when this rabbi was a boy, his father had passed away. And his mother was left with all the children alone. And this boy, David Cohen, his parents, his father, had taken it upon themselves to help this rabbi's family. And they used to bring them food before Shabbos. And they used to bring them food before holidays. And they would come over and help and sometimes send a little something to help her out. You know, she was a widow, orphans. And at one point, the father of this David Cohen had lent his mother, the rabbi's mother, an exorbitant amount of money to the tune of approximately $5,000. And it helped to start a business. And this rabbi knew, because his mother had told him before she died, that he had never paid him back. The family had never been able to pay back that David Cohen's father for the loan. And David Cohen's father, right, was still owed this money for all these years, and it was something that had always bothered him. And he never knew where he was, and he had done such a chesed. So he says to him, David Cohen, wait a second. He says, never mind $100. Your father lent my mother $5,000 to start a business, and she promised she would pay him back. And she was never able to pay him back. I want to get you that money. The guy starts crying. Starts crying on the bus. They're sitting on the bus to Meir Shearim. The guy starts crying. He says, what are you crying for? He says, the reason that I was at the hotel was because my father passed away. And this was the year anniversary of his death, of his yahrzeit. And I came to the hotel because I'm having difficulties financially with my business. And I had a dream. And my father came to me in the dream and said, go to the hotel on my yahrzeit, on the anniversary of my death. So I felt I had to do this, even though I have no money. And I made the trip, and I came to the hotel on his yahrzeit. So you can imagine the end of the story. Sometimes the challenge is to go against your nature, to suddenly take a look at yourself and to say, who am I? And sometimes it's not a question of the sum total of my existence. Sometimes I look at myself after a given act, and I say, am I this person? Does this act reflect who I am? Is this who I want to be? Is this the type of character that I want to be? And sometimes, being forced to step outside of your character is what determines your ability to give up everything for a higher purpose. To a certain extent, that's what's being asked of Avraham here. Because you can create yourself in the mold of such a good person. Goodness can so be who you are that you can forget that ultimately that goodness itself is for a purpose. And so somehow God comes along to Abraham and says, I want you to step outside. Now there's a saying that the Baal Shem Tov has, that when you see someone suffering, it's usually because you've done something to cause that type of suffering to someone else. If you see someone desecrate Shabbat, and if it causes you pain, it's usually because there's a problem with your Shabbat. That's our problem today. We spend too much time looking at how other people are messing up and not thinking about how we're messing up. If I see someone being rude to someone, says the Baal Shem Tov, and this is a very deep mystical idea, I have to say to myself, wait a second, if I'm seeing this, it must mean that I need to work on this as well. So now here's Avraham. If the Baal Shem Tov, founder of Chassidut, right, 17th century, master of the good name, if the Baal Shem Tov says this, then this must be true with Avraham. So Avraham has to ask himself, why am I being forced to see the suffering in the eyes of my son? Give me an answer. And it was after these things. Give me an answer. Yishmael. It's not accidental that this story follows Yishmael. And I want to tell you something very interesting. God comes to Abraham in the story of Isaac. He comes to Abraham in the story of Yishmael. Abraham arises early in the morning in the story of Yishmael, and he arises early in the morning in the story of Isaac. Abraham is forced to send Yishmael and his wife out alone into the desert, and thus Abraham is forced to go alone into the desert with his son. Abraham causes, whether right or wrong, a mother to have to watch her son lie close to death. Abraham will himself be forced to watch his son near death. An angel comes to Hagar, the mother of Yishmael, and says, go back to the tent of Abraham. And an angel comes at the end of this story and says, go back. Now you can go back to the tent of Abraham. Now you can be who you are. I want to tell you how magnificent this is. I want to tell you why we read this on Rosh Hashanah. Abraham, the first Jew, the epitome of kindness. Even Abraham can mess up. I love that. I think that's magnificent. I can't think of a greater message to teach my children. That you can be an Abraham and you can mess up. Now don't get me wrong, and I've said this before. Abraham's mess ups are not my mess ups. But still, God says to Abraham, listen, kol asher tomar lecha Sarah, whatever Sarah says to you, tishma b'kola, listen to her voice. And Abraham comes to Sarah and says, tasi, you know, hatov b'naich, do whatever you think is right. You know what Abraham has to be thinking in these 3 days? You know what he has to be thinking, in my opinion, to be an Abraham, when his son is lying there on the altar? What could I have said? What could I have done? You know, it's so easy to say, God told me to do it. God says do it. That's not what Judaism wants. Judaism wants me to struggle with my perception of what God wants of me. And Abraham knows, God knows that Abraham has this potential. Because God says to Abraham, I'm going to destroy Sodom. And Abraham doesn't just accept it. He struggles with it. But sometimes, the big picture, you can remember. The little, the micro, you kind of lose it. And so Abraham doesn't pull a Sodom when it comes to Yishmael. And there Abraham fails. And the Jewish people are paying for that failure ever since. What could Abraham have done? Could Abraham have argued with God? Could Abraham have gone with Ishmael into the desert? Could Abraham have determined that Ishmael would leave the house with far more than just a jug of water and a loaf of bread? Could Abraham have welcomed them back into the home? Could Abraham have sat down and found a way to talk to Sarah? And don't get me wrong, it could be that Yitzchak and Ishmael couldn't live in the same house. That doesn't mean the solution is for Ishmael to die. And by the way, it's very interesting that ultimately, at the end of that story, when Abraham dies, he is buried. Look in chapter 25, verse 8. This is an unbelievable verse. Verse 8. Vayigva vayamat Avraham. Abraham dies. Beseva, tova, zakein v'saveh. Of good old age, satisfied. Vayaseh felamav, and he's gathered up unto his people. Vayikberu oto Yitzchak v'Yishmael banav. And both his sons buried him. Isaac and Yishmael. And the rabbis say that at the end of Yishmael's life, he comes back to the fold. And the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, says that this is a prophecy. That one day Jew and Arab will learn to live together. That we will struggle with each other. Now this is a book that was written almost 2,000 years ago. That we will struggle with each other. And that Yishmael will go into the desert and become a desert people. And that's very true. But that one day Yishmael will return and we will learn to live together in peace. The how, the why, the where, the what if, the when, the how to sign the contract. I'm not talking politics. It's a magnificent dream. That can only be because Isaac learned the lesson along with Abraham at the binding of Isaac. The structure of this story seems to suggest that Abraham is being tested. And I can only speak from the perspective of a father. I imagine that it's a little more difficult in this situation for the father than for the son. I don't know that we can ever come to that conclusion. That's too much to reach out for, too far beyond our experience. But certainly the verses seem to suggest that this is Abraham acting and Isaac responding. Does Abraham pass the test? And I want you to know the conventional commentary is that he does. That he's willing to do all for God. That he puts that which is most dear to him on the line. That he has faith that if God wants him to do something, and you know, this should not be confused with all the things that have been done in history in the name of religion. It's very easy to think God is talking to you. This whole story only works if God is actually talking to you. Because if God created everything, and God created you, and God created me, and everything else, then ultimately if something comes from God, I have to struggle with it. That's the challenge. But in the end, post facto, I have to find a way to live with it and accept it. But there's a very interesting comment that Rashi makes on this verse. Look at what God commands Abraham. He says in verse 2, Lech lecha l'eretz ha-Moriah, go to the land of Moriah, v'ha'aleihu sham le'ola, and offer him up as an ola, as an offering. An ola is a type of offering. It happens to be that the offering called an ola is a whole burnt offering. In other words, they take the whole animal and it's completely consumed. The people who bring that animal don't eat any of it. But it doesn't say burnt. Offer him up as an ola. As a total offering would be a more accurate translation. As a complete offering. As an offering. Now Rashi, and I want you to know if Rashi didn't say this, and if the Meshech Chachmah of Meir Simcha of Dvinsk didn't have this comment on Rashi, I don't know that I could say this. I'm basing myself on a comment that Rashi makes. But Rashi says an unbelievable thing. Very simple line. He says, Lo ne'emar shachteu ela v'ha'alehu. What could it have said? It could have said what? God would tell Abraham to do what to his son? I mean, based on the story. Sacrifice him. What else? What other verb? God comes to Abraham and he says, I want you to, your son. What? Kill him. Slaughter him. And Rashi makes that point. He says, you know, it's interesting. It doesn't say kill him. It doesn't say slaughter him. It says offer him up. Now, what does Rashi mean? And the Meshech Chachmah of Meir Simcha of Dvinsk has a phenomenal comment. But I'll tell you a story. You ever hear of Hillel Zeitlin? Hillel Zeitlin was a prolific writer, philosopher, all sorts of issues, religiously and others. He ended up in the Warsaw Ghetto. And towards the end, when the Nazis, Yamach Shamam, were doing their final roundups, their actions in the ghetto, and they reached his block, and it was quite clear the Jews knew exactly what was going on, where they were being taken, what was going to happen to them. And Jews, I don't know if you saw Schindler's List. That's a frightening... Did you see that movie, Schindler's List? Anybody who didn't see it, you should see it. There's a couple of minutes where there's a visual portrait, as it were, of that scene. Of Jews running and hiding. And the stories that have come out of those particular activities are just... They're heartbreaking. If you're here at Tisha B'Av, I'm sure you'll hear a lot of them. You'll certainly will from me. Hillel Zeitlin put on a talis. And he put on his tefillin. Prayer shawl tefillin. He walked out into the street, straight up to the Obersturmführer and the troops. And in a loud voice he said, Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu L'kadesh Et Shemcha B'Rabim. He made a blessing. Blessing God for having commanded us to fulfill the commandment to sanctify your name in public. And he was taken to Auschwitz and he was killed. And he believed that he was fulfilling a divine will. Now that's a very difficult story and a level that I can't even begin to imagine. Rabbi Riskin once told the story in one of his Wednesday night lectures. And there was a person there who was visually upset. Even angry. And immediately after the lecture, he came over to Rav Riskin. His name is Mr. Tiefenbrunn. Mr. Tiefenbrunn lives in Efrat today. He made Aliyah at the age of 72. He's now 87 years old. He's an unbelievable individual, he and his wife. And I have to tell you his story in order to understand his comment. He was married with three children. And he lived in a little village outside of Warsaw. Maybe I'll tell you the story to tell you that story. When Rav Riskin was first the rabbi... We're now on a tangent of a tangent of a tangent. When Rabbi Riskin was first the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue, way back when it was just an apartment in Lincoln Towers, so there was a dispute the first year, second year, of who would daven, who would be the cantor for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And there was one guy who had a beautiful voice, there was one guy who was a Torah scholar, whatever, and the whole community was split down the middle, who it should be, who would daven. So they finally came to Rabbi Riskin. This person has davened before, but this person has a nicer voice. This person has a nicer voice, but this person knows the prayers. You know what? What should they do? So Riskin didn't know what to do. One thing was clear to him. Neither of those guys could daven. Because you couldn't have one person davening in the face of the other person not davening, praying. So he went to Mr. Tiefenbrunn. Mr. Tiefenbrunn had already been in the shul a couple of years. He was a Torah scholar. He was the one who had started the Dafyomi Shiur, the daily class of Talmud in the synagogue. He had gotten Rabbi Riskin to give this class. You could always see him, and I grew up seeing this man walking everywhere with a Talmud under his arm. His sons were the epitome of Jewish traditional upbringing, whatever that means. And he said to Mr. Tiefenbrunn knows how to daven. I actually learned Nusach, some of the tunes for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and other things from Mr. Tiefenbrunn. Beautiful voice. And he said, listen, you daven. You daven, you're respected, that'll solve the issue. He said, no, sorry, I'm not interested. He said, listen, you know, I know you know the Nusach, I've heard you daven. I know, I've heard you sing while somebody else is praying, so you be the one, what's the problem? No, not interested. So Rav Riskin pressed him for a day, 2 days, a few days. You have to daven, there's discord among the community, you can bring shalom, you can bring peace to the community, it's very important, I want you to daven. Finally, Mr. Tiefenbrunn lost it. He said, I'm not going to pray on Yom Kippur because I eat on Yom Kippur. And I don't think it's right that I should be the one praying for the congregation if I don't fast. Thank you very much. So I was like, this is the guy who walks around with a Talmud under his arm. This is the guy who started a Talmud class. So he pressed him some more and he said, you got to tell me why you don't fast on Yom Kippur. So Mr. Tiefenbrunn finally told him the story. He was married, he had three children, and they lived in a village outside of Warsaw. When the Nazis came, they thought that it was like every other time. When the Russians had come, and the Germans had come, and the Russians had come back and forth in that area of Poland. They wanted the Jewish boys for the army. So what'd they do? And throughout the 200 years preceding the Holocaust, Jewish boys would be taken off to the Tsar's army for 20, 25 years, and that meant the end of religion. And there were all sorts of systems that the Jews used to avoid this. Sometimes they mutilated themselves, they cut off their thumbs. Sometimes they changed their names so that they could avoid being counted. And sometimes they went off into hiding from village to village to avoid being taken to the Tsar's army. So they ran into the forest, And they left the women and children behind. Because they thought they were after the young men for the army, like every other time in Jewish history. And they didn't realize this time was different. He never saw his wife and children again. He eventually made his way through the forests, and he got out, and he ended up in Shanghai. On VE Day, on the day that they announced the victory over Germany, over Europe, he heard that his wife and children were shot. He said, I have to do something to rebel against God. I'm not willing to take this lying down. And in order to maintain my sanity, I have to have some act of rebellion. Some point in my year that I say to God, no, I'm not willing to accept this. So I don't fast on Yom Kippur. That's my answer to God. He said, I can't accept that there's no God. But I'm not willing to let God think that I'm willing to move on. So in the end, Rabbi Riskin talked to him. He ended up fasting that Yom Kippur. He ended up davening that Yom Kippur, because that's Rabbi Riskin. But he was sitting in this lecture, Mr. Tiefenbrunn, when Rabbi Riskin told that story in the midst of a discussion about Kiddush Hashem, about the mitzvah of sanctifying God's name. And he was very upset. And he came over to Rabbi Riskin at the end of the lecture, and he said to him, I don't accept what you just said. I don't accept that there was a sanctification of God's name in the Holocaust. What Kiddush Hashem was there? They had no choice. They didn't have choice. They were all sent to death. If you tell me, murder someone else or be killed, and I choose to die, that's a sanctification of God's name. If you tell me, commit adultery, or bow down to an idol, or I'm going to kill you, and you choose, rather than bow down to an idol, to sanctify, that's a Kiddush Hashem. But what sanctification of God's name was in the Holocaust? So I'll tell you what Riskin said. He said, sometimes sanctification of God's name is choosing whether to live or die. Sometimes the sanctification of God's name is choosing how you're going to die. That's a very powerful idea. We in our generation, we grew up with the state of Israel as a given. But for 2,000 years, Jews bent before the storm. They were the reed against the wind. They chose not to rebel, but to lie under their beds during the pogroms and to get up the next morning and to pick up the ashes. That was how they survived. The Holocaust changed that. It gave the Jews the final message that they had to be willing to put it on the line again, to fight, to stand up in a different way than they'd been standing up till then. But I want to go you a stage further, because I think, and this is what the Meshech Chachma is saying, much deeper than the challenge of how to die for God is how you live for God. You see, I can sanctify God's name every day by how I choose to live my life. And that's what Abraham is being told. God says to him, offer him up. Your son has to be a living sacrifice before God, an offering before God in everything he does. And if you want your son to be that living sacrifice, if you want your son to be a living example, if you want to teach him how to live for God, you can't teach him that by sending Yishmael out of the house. And so it may well be that according to Meshech Chachma, that Abraham misses something. And that Abraham thinks that what God is asking of him is what the rest of the world was doing. That I sanctified by God's name by giving up the life of my son, by killing my son for God. And comes along God in the vestige of an angel and says, no, that's not what I want. I want you to teach your son how to live for me. And that's why at the end of the story he says, Atayadati, now I know. Now I know that you truly have a relationship with me because you didn't hold back your son from me. Because you're willing to give your son ultimately to this purpose. But how does he know that? He doesn't know that by what Avram does. I think maybe he knows it by what Yitzchak does. Because if Yitzchak can lie on that altar, then it means that that message has been communicated to Yitzchak. That's an incredible idea. And the reason I read this on Rosh Hashanah is because that's the question we ask ourselves every day. How do I develop a relationship with God? How do I discover what the ethic that I want from God is? How do I find a way in this world, to allow that relationship that I can develop with a loving, caring God, how do I allow that to make the world a more loving and more caring place? How do I become a more loving and more caring person? How do I make my day a day in the service of a higher ideal? Of the rest of humanity, of the rest of the world, of God? That's the challenge of the Akedah. How do I bind myself up? How does every activity in my life become a part of my determination to make myself a better person, to make my environment a better environment, to make the world a better place? That's the challenge of the Akedah. So there are a lot of questions that are left unanswered, and that's good. Food for thought. There's a lot more to be seen in this story. But Bezrat Hashem, we will continue, I think, next with the story of Yaakov and Esav. So, food for thought.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.